Hey everyone, welcome back to The Forum, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Daniela.
Along with Aubrey and Cleo as well.
And for those of you listening in, thanks for socializing with science today.
If you, at home, want to join the conversation, be sure to tweet us your questions, comments, and opinions with @ISGPForum and the hashtag ISGPForum. And you'll find our show on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
Today's podcast will discuss a debate that occurred at one of our food safety, security, and defense conferences, which was held in April 2015 in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Food Safety, Security, and Defense, Production and Sustainability was the name of the conference.
And the paper in question, titled Regulatory Oversight of New Plant and Animal Varieties in the United States, was written by Dr. Allison Van Inenem, a biotechnology specialist at the University of California, Davis.
New plant and animal varieties, huh? I mean, with my new job on the farm, I come across plant and animal varieties that are new to me every day, but that's just me. Are we talking about discovering new varieties in the wild?
Well, we could call it a discovery of sorts, but it might be better understood as a creation.
Wait, we can create new plants and animals? You have my attention.
All right, you two, let's take a step back and clear a few things up before Cleo starts playing Frankenstein in her head, or starts playing mad scientist out there on the farm with her animals.
Oh, come on, I wouldn't compare this to Frankenstein's monster creation. It would definitely have a happier ending.
Well, good, because the idea of creating new plant and animal varieties is often accompanied by fear and resistance.
Anyway, to answer your question, Cleo, we can indeed create new varieties through a process called genetic engineering, or GE, the direct manipulation of an organism's genome using biotechnology. This includes transferring genes within a certain type of plant species, or even across species, in order to create a new variety. Many in the general public have strong opinions about using GE technology to create new organisms, and we've actually discussed it on several episodes of the forum now.
Actually, GE technologies are currently used on a regular basis in a variety of applications. For instance, insulin injections for diabetics and therapeutics for cancer patients utilize GE and are publicly accepted.
Exactly. And Dr. Van Inenem argues that GE plants and animals have provided and will continue to provide opportunities for food production and sustainability in the future.
That's great. But I know for sure that my grandma has never heard of these touted opportunities and possible benefits. Why is that?
Well, that could be for two reasons. First, the conversation surrounding genetic modification is definitely still controversial concerning its safety. In addition, the regulatory system overseeing GMO's development makes it too expensive to explore their potential.
Is all of that actually justified, though? Could genetic modification be dangerous?
Well, no unique risks to animal or human health have been associated with the use of GE over the past 20 years.
Wait. How do you know that?
Actually, Cleo, she's right. In the Journal of Animal Science, Allison Van Inenem and fellow geneticist Amy Young published the largest study ever conducted. They reviewed 29 years of livestock productivity and health data from both before and after the introduction of GE animal feed. The field data represented more than 100 billion animals.
What did they find?
Well, there were no indications of any unusual trends in the health of animals since 1996, when GMO crops were first harvested. Considering the size of the data set, it can reasonably be said that the debate over the impact of GE feed on animal health is closed. There is zero impact.
All right, so no impact on animal health. Got it. But what about human health?
Well, the authors also address the implications of their study on human health. No study has revealed any differences in the nutritional profile of animal products derived from GE-fed animals. Because DNA and protein are normal components of the diet that are digested, there are no detectable or reliably quantifiable traces of GE components in milk, meat, and eggs following consumption of GE feed.
Which actually brings us to a point that Dr. Van Inenem argued quite a bit. She believes that regulatory efforts must be proportional to the risk posed by the product being evaluated.
That seems fair, but debaters did raise concerns about the introduction of GE plants and animals having negative effects that proliferate biologically in nature. Human health impacts were questioned as well, as some participants wondered if modern technologies are reducing the nutritional value or safety of food.
That said, it was agreed that all foods should be subjected to the same regulatory standards. Currently, traditionally bred crops are not subjected to the same regulatory restrictions as their GE equivalents. While traditional breeders are responsible for self-regulating their production processes and are trusted not to breed new varieties that are harmful to consumers, developers of GE foods are not.
Right. Currently, identical products produced using different breeding methods are subjected to vastly different levels of regulatory scrutiny, simply because of the process used to create them.
What do you mean when you say identical products?
Well, whether a new variety of plant is created using conventional breeding or genetic modification, the end products are identical. The only apparent difference is that conventional breeding takes decades of crossbreeding to transfer the sought genes and evolve the crop into the new variety. Genetic modification instead dramatically shortens this lengthy process by using technologies to directly take the same gene from one plant and transfer it into the other to create the new variety. In the end, the new plant variety, or end product, is the same regardless of which method was used to make it.
Okay, I think I'm beginning to understand, although still a bit fuzzy.
Well, my mind is immediately drawn to a physical chemistry explanation of state and path functions, which is actually a perfect analogy in this case, but I know for a fact that it's not going to help you.
Okay, Cleo, let me try to explain it like this. When you're playing Pokemon, there are two different ways that your Pokemon can evolve into its new form. The conventional and traditional way that takes a very long time, so the Pokemon takes a long time to adapt to new levels until it finally evolves into the fully fledged new form. Or you can use the evolution stone to skip all of the time needed to evolve your Pokemon conventionally. Both methods leave you with the identical evolved Pokemon in the end.
I am literally shocked at your level of nerdiness at this point, Daniela.
Hey, you were literally just talking about state and path functions. What even is a path function?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm with Aubrey on this one. I appreciate you trying to help with your explanation, Daniela, but I think you are the only person I know that has that level of Pokemon experience to appreciate such an analogy.
Come on, guys. You can't tell me that you didn't catch them all on your Game Boys growing up.
Certainly did not catch them all, not even one. But anyway, I understand the process now after such an intellectual explanation.
All right. Good. I'm glad it helped at least a little bit, even if I know you will never let me live that one down. But anyway, back to the point. Although these two processes produce the same apparent end result, the level of regulatory scrutiny for those that are genetically engineered is much higher.
Yep, and in Dr. Van Eenennaam's opinion, the current process-based trigger for regulatory evaluation of GE plants and animals is disincentivizing the development of GE crops that could contribute to global food security and agricultural sustainability. She argues that it's time to refocus regulatory evaluations on both the risks and the benefits posed by novel traits in new varieties of crops and animals, and to evaluate all new traits the same, regardless of the breeding method that was used to introduce them.
Both Dr. Van Eenennaam and the debaters made the point that GE technologies could be beneficial for food security in both affluent and less affluent countries. For example, about 20% of animal products are lost to disease globally each year, so the introduction of disease-resistant traits could ensure that food quantities improve.
On top of that, in regions where nutrients are lacking in local diets, biofortification of crops could be used to improve the nutritional quality of produce.
Yep, and food security challenges associated with water scarcity and droughts could be ameliorated by introducing drought resistance into plant species.
All right, so I see the issue here. You're saying that this sort of application of GE technologies can't be realized until the regulatory system switches from a focus on the breeding process used to create new plant and animal traits to a focus on the risk and benefits of those traits.
Exactly. The financial burdens associated with the current system are preventing scientists and breeders from developing beneficial GE products. A new regulatory process would have to be developed and accepted by policymakers and government regulatory organizations alike. And we all know how much time and effort that would take.
Well, there's already disagreement about whether benefits outweigh the risks, since an identified risk will be present even if benefits arise from the technology.
Well, it was suggested that crops produced by both traditional and GE methods be evaluated in the same manner, But this also raised concerns that if GE crops and traditional crops were evaluated using the same regulatory checklist, consumers might panic regarding all food sources, since traditionally bred products would then be compared to supposedly risky GE varieties.
Well, panic should be the last thing regulatory systems create. They're only in place to protect. They provide a way for society to find a balance among the potential benefits, risks, and concerns associated with new technologies.
Oh, of course. And in fact, they're absolutely vital when structured in an efficient way. Under the United States Coordinated Framework for the Regulation of Biotechnology, the system serves to find this very balance of risks and benefits, as it is technically neutral towards the process under review.
According to the Office of Science and Technology Policy, or OSTP, oversight should be based on the risk posed by the introduction and not on whether an organism has been modified by a particular process or technique like genetic engineering. OSTP says oversight is needed, quote, only where the risk posed by the introduction is unreasonable, that is, when the value of the reduction in risk obtained by additional oversight is greater than the cost thereby imposed, unquote.
All right, so let's decode that for a second. So this is saying that the U.S. only exercises regulatory authority over organisms, plant or animal, based on the risks they pose, regardless of the breeding techniques used to produce them, right? So what's the problem?
Well, this is how it's supposed to work, but the problem is that, in practice, this is not what happens. The United States Department of Agriculture's regulatory process for GE plants is triggered by the dependence of any genetic modification upon a plant pest.
Plant pest?
Yeah, meaning any infectious agents or substances which can directly or indirectly injure or cause disease or damage to any processed, manufactured, or other products of plants.
Right, and older GE techniques rely on the use of genetic components coming from pests or viruses in order to actually create the new varieties, especially those making crops resistant to diseases. Consequently, this resulted in a de facto process-based regulatory regime of GE plants by the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service.
This is coming back to me from the debate. The same issue happens under regulation of modified animals, right? The trigger for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's regulation of GE animals is if the animals are modified by recombinant DNA techniques. And this isn't just the animal modified, but every animal connected to its lineage, which means although the regulatory evaluation is based on the end product GE animal, the method used to produce the genetic change that results in the product is the trigger for regulatory oversight. In other words, even the far-flung offspring of a GE cow made with recombinant DNA would be subject to regulation.
Right, and it's not just the regulation itself that makes it difficult to take advantage of these opportunities. The financial barriers are also immense. The average cost of discovery, development, and authorization of a new trait introduced into an organism using GE between 2008 and 2012 was $136 million and took approximately 13 years from product concept to launch.
But those costs are not due to only the regulatory process, right?
Well, on average, about 26% of those costs were incurred as part of the regulatory testing and global registration process.
And in terms of time, the longest phase of product development is regulatory science and registration activities, approximately 5.5 years.
Wow, well, I can certainly understand how this disincentivizes the development of GE products, especially when over the past 20 years, the FDA found all of the transgenic crop processes evaluated to be substantially equivalent to their conventional counterparts, and even regulators from other countries found the same results.
Exactly. If regulatory oversight should be exercised only when the risk posed by the introduction of a new variety is unreasonably high, as stated by the OSTP, then Dr. Van Inenem argues that there's no rationale for imposing additional regulations on GE crops if they exhibit the same traits as unregulated crops produced by classical breeding techniques.
Right. She argues that process-based regulatory oversight would seem to be justified only if there was something inherently risky about the process that results in unreasonable risks in the product.
Take the hornless dairy cow, for instance. Say you created said cow by editing the gene for horns in such a way that the gene had exactly the same sequence that appears in other breeds of cattle. Dr. Van Eenennaam questions why a hornless cow should be required to go through a multi-million dollar regulatory review when an animal with exactly the same genotype and phenotype produced using crossbreeding would have no oversight.
That exact issue has been happening in real life with the fast-growing AquaAdvantage GE salmon. It was first developed in 1989 and had been caught in regulatory limbo for years until now. Development and regulatory costs have exceeded $77 million. In contrast, there's no regulatory oversight of the same traits introduced using conventional breeding techniques, including fast-growing Atlantic salmon produced using conventional approaches.
Mm-hmm. The AquaAdvantage GE salmon was finally approved in early 2016, making it the first GE animal approved for food consumption in the world. But even if this is a huge milestone for GE technology, the process it had to undergo is not very encouraging for other people who might want to try their hand at GE development and breeding.
I recall Dr. Van Eenennaam arguing that the prohibitive cost of achieving regulatory approval has limited the development of improved GE plant and animal varieties by public sector scientists and small companies.
Not to mention farmers from less affluent nations. Of the estimated 18 million farmers currently growing GE crops, more than 16 million of them operate in less affluent nations. While this holds economic promise for developing countries, it also makes it difficult for their products to enter certain markets.
And Dr. Van Eenennaam is right about the public sector's limited capacity to enter the field. To date, only 5 of the 167 GE products, that's 3%, that have been commercialized in the United States originate from research developed within the public sector.
Understandably, public sector breeders have instead chosen to improve the majority of crops using unregulated techniques, which are often less precise and more time-consuming. As a result, socially and environmentally valuable technologies, as well as non-commodity crop projects, are noticeably absent from the market.
With the exception of disease-resistant papaya.
Yes, of course, except for papaya. We'll get to that in a minute.
But actually, guys, this is exactly the problem. The most profound implications of the high cost of regulation include delays in the global distribution of technologies, which has resulted in disincentives for investing in further research and development using GE as a breeding method, which potentially may prevent higher rates of growth in the global food supply.
Some of these new varieties are really exciting and introduce broad consumer and environmental benefits, such as nutritionally fortified crops and disease-resistant plants and animals.
To be fair, there are still a large number of publicly developed GE crops in the development pipeline, like oranges that are resistant to citrus greening disease.
And blight-resistant chestnut trees.
And of course, a host of vitamin-fortified crops for the developing world.
But there are also many GE specialty crops like fungus-resistant strawberries developed by public sector scientists who just don't have the money to go through the current process-based regulatory system.
However, plant and animal scientists are beginning to find ways around the current regulations. A number of GE crops in development will likely fall outside of the scope of current regulations by using two different techniques. First is by deliberate design, meaning scientists produce novel crops without any plant pest-derived genetic components.
And second is through the development of new technologies for genetic manipulation that involve precision editing of the genome. These new breeding methods enable the creation of targeted DNA base pair changes, and most importantly, there will often be no way to differentiate genetic changes intentionally made using these new methods from those resulting from naturally occurring mutations.
Even so, Dr. Van Eenennaam believes that strategic maneuvers should not be necessary to ease regulation. Instead, it was urged at the debate that it is time to refocus regulatory oversight of new varieties of plants and animals onto their risk-benefit profiles as posed by novel traits, irrespective of the breeding technique used to produce them.
But the question remains, guys, how exactly do we do this? What do we focus on?
Well, first of all, debaters actually agreed that regulatory evaluations must consider not only risks, but also explicitly consider the potential benefits resulting from the novel traits, which seems like a no-brainer, but it hasn't really been achieved in practice.
It was suggested that the successful implementation and acceptance of GE Hawaiian papaya could be used as an example of how to structure the acceptance of alternative GE products in the future. Emphasis was placed on the fact that the incorporation of GE papaya into the marketplace was based on three main characteristics. One, development by public sector scientists at the University of Hawaii. 2. The disappearance of papaya from the market if the technology was not adopted. And 3. The perceived safety of a disease-resistant trait.
The debaters were adamant that new foods made with any technology must be evaluated by the FDA using a scientific, risk-based approach, and that any new food traits, such as changes in a macronutrient, an increase in natural toxicant, or the presence of novel allergens, must be the trigger for greater food safety evaluation and regulation.
Debaters also agreed that product labeling rules should be based on product attributes. For example, if an allergen is introduced into a product, such as a peanut trait expressed in a tomato, then the product should be labeled with the appropriate risk information. But it was agreed that it is not necessary to require a product to be labeled simply because its breeding process is different from traditional breeding.
So the suggested plan, supported by Dr. Van Inenam and others in the debate, is that regulatory oversight of new plant and animal foods, whether created by GE or traditional breeding, would, 1, identify what new trait has been expressed in the organism, 2, decide whether a risk is associated with that trait's expression, and then 3, perform a governmental evaluation if a risk is recognized. However, this proposal was met with resistance by some debaters who expressed concern regarding the unknown consequences of genetic engineering as a whole in food production.
But like Daniela mentioned at the beginning of our episode, people currently tend to distrust GE food products for a variety of reasons, including fear of the unknown and future impacts of new technology. So what needs to be done in order to maximize the potential benefits of GE foods while also addressing legitimate concerns about the safety of this technology?
Well, first we should get to the bottom of why people tend to fear GE foods in the first place.
Well, from personal experience, before I learned about the science behind GE, I too mistrusted GE foods, without even knowing why. Debaters agreed that distrust can be perpetuated through unreliable sources of information, such as celebrities or popular media outlets.
That's true, but in the same vein, or I guess I should say DNA strain actually, distrust is also perpetuated through the prevailing perception that regulatory agencies are influenced by large food producers and manufacturers that use financial incentives to accelerate regulatory approval. But then again, debaters generally agreed that it would be impossible to influence all of the many regulatory agencies involved in GE technology regulation.
And the most challenging concern to address is the health and environmental safety of GE food products. We should always keep in mind that technologies that were once thought to be safe in the past were discovered to be dangerous far after their use became normalized, such as DDT.
And because GE foods only have about 20 years worth of research under their belts, it makes this concern difficult to address. This, along with the need to understand that zero risk is impossible to achieve under any process, may pose difficulties in mitigating fears. That said, we can definitely do something about the misinformation and misperceptions.
Yeah, always looking on the bright side, Dee. Debaters suggested that we could turn to education. These perceptions of fear and mistrust need to be addressed prior to the implementation of risk-benefit analysis as the preferred tool for determining product safety.
It could be useful in this sense to identify shared values between GE crop and traditional crop production, such as mitigating climate change and lessening environmental footprints, as well as changing the GE conversation to address how new technologies can help achieve these shared values.
You bring up a good point. It was mentioned that GE crops could in fact improve environmental well-being and sustainability, since certain genetic improvements in the past have been shown to decrease environmental footprints. Introducing disease resistance would lessen the need to spray chemicals or treat crops in the field, protecting the environment while maintaining productivity.
Well, now it's your turn to weigh in on social media. We're looking forward to learning what you thought of today's episode. Do you think GE crops could improve agricultural sustainability? Do you think the regulatory system should be changed to focus on the end product rather than the process?
Should conventional breeding practices and genetic engineering practices be evaluated by the same regulatory standards?
Tweet us your thoughts using the hashtag ISGPForum, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at ISGPForum.
And don't forget to like us on Facebook as well.
Thanks for joining us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy today. Hope you enjoyed socializing with science, and we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.